I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with a Hoosier author whose new novel is creating a lot of buzz in literary circles. Deborah Kennedy's Tornado Weather, in fact, is set here in Indiana. We'll talk with her about the book, about how she came to write, and about how Indiana figures in her fiction. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. We hope you will join the conversation. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. A new Hoosier author has published a novel that's created a lot of buzz in the literary world. It's called Tornado Weather. The author is Deborah Kennedy. It's set in a somewhat fictional Indiana town. I think a lot of people who are from Indiana will be able to recognize some parts of it. She is our guest today. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, Deborah Kennedy, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you here. So, big week for you, obviously, right?
Yes, it's been really exciting. Kind of surreal, actually.
In what ways?
Well, I think writers, we work alone in rooms, just our keyboards usually, and to have my work actually out in the world being read by people other than my family, I'm just not quite used to it, but it's been quite a thrill so far.
What was it like seeing the book in its actual physical form for the first time?
It's hard to explain that feeling. I think I felt proud, I suppose, because it has been a long time coming. I've been working on this book since 2009. So that made me really happy. My mom and I actually opened the box of hard covers together. I dedicate the book to her and my father, and she started crying. And so that was kind of a cool experience, I guess.
So we're going to talk at length about the book. And I should say at the outset, I enjoyed and admired your book.
Thank you.
And probably just so our listeners, many of whom, because the book just came out 2 days ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Officially. So many of our listeners won't have had a chance to read it yet. I was trying to think of how I would describe what this book is. The closest I could sort of come up with is, Winesburg, Ohio, with kind of a mystery attached to it at some level.
I like that.
But it's different in that, with Winesburg, you've got that one protagonist who's sort of walking through everything and is more your guide through the town. And this is it's more. So I'm going to ask you instead to talk about... Tell people sort of what Tornado Weather is.
Well, I guess to just kind of give a short plot summary, I would say that it's the story of a small fictional Indiana town during a summer that a young girl goes missing. And my goal in writing this book to a certain extent was I wanted to tell the story of a town. I think that that's probably... more the heart of the story than the mystery, even though the mystery, of course, is very important. I wanted each character kind of to serve as almost a thread in the tapestry of this town. And so each chapter really follows a different character in the course of, a short period in their life during the summer where a character named Daisy Gonzalez goes missing from her bus stop. I guess that's kind of how I would... summarize it.
Yeah, it is, if anything, when I thought about it, okay, I don't even know at some level who the main character is. when I'm reading this, and then I realize, well, really, the town is the main character.
Yeah.
That's really what we're attempting to depict here, and the life of this community. Obviously written with some authority, the authority of personal experience, which gets us to the point of talking about, you're from Indiana, right?
I am. I'm from Fort Wayne.
Fort Wayne. What part of Fort Wayne?
The northern part of Fort Wayne. Yeah, kind of the northern suburbs.
So which high school? Because I know that's important in Fort Wayne.
I went to Northrop High School. Go Bruins!
Okay. Northrop High School, and then you also went to college here in Indiana.
I did. I went to Hanover College in Hanover, Indiana.
Okay. So was writing something you always wanted to do? I'm always kind of curious about that moment when people decide that they want to write and write seriously.
It was. I was a avid reader as a child. I was very shy. It was hard for me to talk to people. So I would a lot of times just sit in corners and read books. And it was something that my father definitely encouraged with me. We would go to the Allen County Public Library almost every Saturday together and get books and then go to Coney Island and have conies. But I think I always wanted to be a writer from kindergarten or first grade on. In first grade, we had a choice to go out and play or we could stay in and write things. And so I would stay in and write things. I was that kind of kid. And then I guess in fifth grade, I think I wrote a really pivotal piece for me. It was the story of a pencil, the kind of a day in the life of a pencil. I personified this pencil and just followed it through its day. Yeah, it was ridiculous. But that was kind of when, I guess it was fifth grade that I decided to start telling people I was going to be a writer. But it really started with reading. And I think that's the case for a lot of writers is, you know, you fall in love with these stories that you read and you want to do that as well. And I think that's really how I got started.
Who were the writers who spoke to you first? Because most when I have talked with writers in the past, it's generally they love some particular writer or some genre or some book or some story, even if they don't end up writing like that writer or that story or anything like that. But it's something that sparked or connected for them. Who were yours?
First of all, I would say Ellen Montgomery, who wrote the Anne of Green Gables series and several other really delightful books set in Prince Edward Island. Those stories really spoke to me. I love the character of Anne. She was so spunky and fun and smart and also clumsy, always getting into trouble. I wasn't like that as a kid. I was a quiet rule obeyer, but I love to read about someone who was like that. So those stories really formed me as a young person. They even kind of gave me some of my moral values. They're lovely that way. And then Madeline L'Engle, a young adult novelist, I adored her writing. And she often wrote about smart misfit girls, and that was definitely who
did
I was.
Did you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. She wrote about girls that weren't necessarily, you know, popular or, you know, in the in crowd. They were sort of on the outside of things, and they had a different perspective because of that. And that's how I felt, and so I could really connect with those characters. So I would say Ellen Montgomery and Madeline L'Engle were incredibly important to me when I was a young girl growing up. And then I got into Jane Eyre, I think. When I was 12, I started reading the Brontes, and I loved just their sort of gothic sensibility. And those were, yeah. And they were all, I don't think it was a coincidence that they were all women that spoke to me at that age.
Now, you mentioned your father encouraged your devotion to reading and all of that. What did your parents do for a living?
They weren't involved with writing at all. My father is actually deceased. He died when I was 20, which was...
I'm sorry.
It was really, really hard for me to lose him at that age because we were so close and because he was such a smart man that encouraged... just independent learning. He worked actually as a repairman of printing presses, typesetting equipment. So he would drive around northern Indiana and southern Michigan fixing typesetting equipment for small newspapers.
Okay.
That's what he did. And then my mom was a homemaker. And so it wasn't necessarily their professions or anything that inspired me, but it was more just how they conducted their lives and then how they instilled in all of us this idea that we could be whatever we wanted.
How many siblings?
I have two older brothers.
Two older brothers. So what was the reaction when you first started saying to your parents that you wanted to write? Because for, you know, a lot of parents will hear that and think, oh, yes, I plan to be unemployed for most of my life. What was their response? Were they supportive?
They were to a certain extent. I think they just thought it was sort of a childish dream, you know, kind of like, I want to be an astronaut or, you know, a ballerina. But at the same time, so I think they wanted me to have sort of a side career, a career so that I could write on the side, more accurate to say that. He wanted me to maybe, you know, study business or something like that, something more practical. But they aren't the kind of parents that were ever going to stop me from doing what I wanted.
So you made the decision then to go to Hanover. What drew you to that school?
Well, it was so beautiful. That's one thing. That campus is gorgeous. You kind of have to see it to believe it. It's on this cliff overlooking the Ohio River. My dad and I took a college tour one summer, and Hanover was the last place we went. And it was just clear for me that all the students that I saw walking around, they looked like me. They seemed down to earth and smart and studious, but like they were also having fun. It just seemed like the kind of atmosphere that I'd like. And then I think too, it was clear from the students that I spoke to that the professors there deeply cared about their students and that they had actual good personal relationships with their professors. And indeed, I'm still very good friends with several of the English professors at Hanover. We still keep in touch, and it's been a long time since I was in college. So that's, I think that really says something about the quality of the teaching there.
And then from there, you went to University of Iowa and the Writers' Workshop?
I did. There were a lot of things that happened in between. I went to Iowa as a rather older student. I think I was about 34 when I went there, and a lot of the students were fresh out of college. But I had worked as a journalist and editor in between times. And I'm actually really glad that I went there at an older age. I felt like my writing had gotten to a point where, I don't know, I just felt like I had more to say at my age, I guess. That's not saying that the young people didn't, but I just felt more in command of my work at that point. So I was excited. And it's a privilege to go to the workshop. They prioritize writing completely. You have 2 years to do very little but write. That's the idea. That's why you're there. Obviously, you study other subjects, but that's the main gist of the curriculum there, is you are just there to write. And I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Hoosier novelist Deborah Kennedy, whose first book, which has been widely praised already, Tornado Weather, just was published on Tuesday. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. You worked as a journalist and an editor. Where did you work and what did you learn from that?
I started off in journalism at a little paper in Northern Kentucky. And I think one of the things that I learned there is just how much people will, the stories that you have to listen to, the stories that people tell you. You have to just be a good listener. And interviewing, I had the privilege of interviewing so many different kinds of people from so many different walks of life. And that helps, I think, that helped me anyway, develop my own voice from listening to others and realizing that everyone has a story. You might not necessarily know it from looking at them, or you might be tempted to write them off, but everyone has a story. And so, you know, I wrote about everything from Rabbit Hash, Kentucky's dog mayor election to some city council things and everything in between. So that was a really great experience. I also worked as an editor at Dramatics Magazine, which is a theater magazine sponsored by the Educational Theater Association in Cincinnati. And I worked for a paper in Fort Wayne called What's Up, which is primarily a music education or music publication, but it's also just a general entertainment paper. So I guess, yeah, just the opportunity to interview all different kinds of people was really the best part of those jobs.
We are talking with Hoosier author Deborah Kennedy, whose debut novel, Tornado Weather, was published on Tuesday. It's a fascinating story. As I say, the best description I've got of it is Winesburg, Ohio, with a little bit of a murder mystery attached to it, or a mystery of sorts. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk with Deborah about the book itself, about its genesis and what she set out to do with it. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Deborah Kennedy, a native Hoosier, whose first novel, Tornado Weather, was officially published on Tuesday and already has won widespread praise. Before the break, we sort of talked about what brought her to this point and what brought her to writing the book. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the book itself. As I say, it's a different book in that it is really one of the things that struck me about it is that A, it is much more a portrait of a community, and that even though some of the characters that you write about are not particularly admirable or likable, you still write about them with a tremendous amount of empathy. Yeah, there aren't any flashing signs there that say, oh, please don't like this person or anything like that, or this is a bad person or anything like that. There is a degree there that you're attempting to understand them. Where did the book come from for you? I mean, when did you, you said you've been working on it since 2009.
Yeah, I started it shortly after I saw a sign in a laundromat in Fort Wayne. The sign said, "No Burmese welcome." And it was in response to the fact that Fort Wayne has a large Burmese refugee population. I'm not sure if I'm correct about this, but I do believe that the Catholic diocese in Fort Wayne began bringing in Burmese refugees around mid-90s, late-90s. And there was a lot of tension in the community between Burmese refugees and the quote-unquote Fort Wayne native population. And I was interested in exploring that after I saw that sign. I don't know, it just sparked something in me. But I frankly just didn't feel qualified to tell that story. I wasn't exactly comfortable with it. And so it sort of morphed more into what you see in Tornado Weather, which is more dealing with the tensions that I think are somewhat more universal, at least in this country, tensions between, again, the quote-unquote native population and Mexican immigrants who come here to work, hoping for a better life. And so it really kind of just kind of came from that place, that idea. I had also heard a story about, in particular, dairies in the U.S. that were hiring a lot of undocumented workers and then really taking advantage of their workers. And that was something, too, that spurred me on. And I started writing the chapter that deals with Gordy, a journalist who basically outs his employer. He exposes him as someone who engages in that practice of hiring people and then taking advantage of them. So I think it really kind of started in a somewhat political place, but also just a desire to tell a somewhat political story and by exploring, you know, the actual human toll of it.
What did the fictional town is called Colliersville, but those of us who know the state realize there are references to Fort Wayne all the way through the book.
Yes.
That it is clearly in Northeast Indiana. Was there a model for it? Or because at first, maybe because I knew you had gone to school in Hanover, early references in the book, I thought, okay, is this in southern Indiana? And then once the references to Fort Wayne start, and some of the other things, the last name Yoder, obviously, was a big signal. Was there a town that served as your model or inspiration? Realizing that you probably, you know, I can't remember the 19th century writer who said that, you know, you turn over an entire library to write a single book, and you can go through, you know, an entire town of people to find a single character.
I don't know who that is. I'm going to have to look that up. It was more kind of an amalgamation, I guess. I thought some of a town called Cherubusco that I spent time in as a child when we'd go to the lake with my family. Also, Angola was an inspiration. I thought about Elkhart as well, simply because of the economic problems that Elkhart has experienced over the recent years. So it was more kind of a combination. There wasn't one particular town that I modeled it on, and just kind of the small town Indiana atmosphere. That was kind of more my idea, was just, and it all just sort of lived in my head. It wasn't really modeled after anything in particular.
When did you settle on the idea? Because the mystery part of it, you know, for a fair bit of the book, I read it and thought, okay, does she really? I'm fascinated by these people. I'm fascinated by this community. I'm not sure I really needed to have a little girl disappear to keep me hooked here. Obviously, and I'm not going to give the payoff. there is an importance to the mystery that you grasp by the end of the book. But at what point did you decide you were going to use the mystery kind of as a motif that ties all of these disparate elements together?
I can't exactly take credit for that, because, as I said, the book has gone through lots of incarnations since I started it. And actually, that was an idea of my editor, frankly. And yeah, I had written this story of this town, and Daisy and her disappearance figured in it, but it didn't figure as largely as it does in the end product here. And I really have to thank my editor at Flatiron, Christine Kopresh, for realizing that was more of the heart of the book than I realized. And I always thought of writing as a individual, solitary thing. Mm-hmm. I'm an introvert. I'm very shy. Mm-hmm. It's not that I don't play well with others, but that was one of the reasons I became a writer, is because I wanted to do things on my own. I suppose there's some control freak in there also. But she started talking to me about revisions that we could make, and really sort of making the story more tightly focused. It's still not tightly focused, as you said, but more tightly focused on Daisy's disappearance, and having that disappearance form more of a backbone to the story.
Yeah, it's interesting because in some ways the mystery, if we're gonna continue the Winesburg comparison, the mystery almost serves the same purposes as George Willard does in Winesburg, where he's kind of the thread that walks through all of these individual stories and keeps them connected. Where did the people come from?
Oh, that's such a good question. They came from all different experiences and moments. I guess I'll mention just a few. Irv Peoples, the roadkill collector, he came from my curiosity and my horror. I'm an animal lover. I think that probably comes through in the book. And Indiana in deer season is a rough place to be. it's just a horror show on the roads of dead deer carcasses everywhere. And so I was just curious. I thought, what would it be like to have to be the person who actually deals with this instead of just drives by? So he came out of kind of just a question. I'll think of, let's see, Shannon Washburn in the Blood Curse chapter. She actually was inspired by a waitress that I saw who helped me, who had feet down, or sorry, feet, who had hair down to her feet almost.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, what would that be like? So I think most of the characters come out of someone that I see or, you know, out in the world, or a question that I have or something I'm curious about and want to know more about. I don't write about myself in fiction. I don't find myself that interesting, and I have a terrible memory, so autobiographical fiction is just not an option. I love it. I love to read it, but I can't write it. I'm more interested in the lives of other people and people who are really different from me. And that kind of gets back to what you said about empathy. I really love my characters, even if they seem to be rather off-putting or, you know, not the best moral people you'd ever meet, but I love them all. And so writing to me is an act of empathy. It's an act of trying to just put yourself in someone else's shoes, imagine what their life is like. And then I'm hoping then that empathy transfers to my reader. They too then are fascinated by this person who's very different from them, but then they realize that they have so much actual common humanity. I don't know if I succeed in that by any means, but that's where I start.
Well, in fair, I think you do, because obviously I felt you disappeared into, and I felt as a reader that I disappeared into these people's lives and, you know, got to a place often where there was a part of me that was suspending judgment with their actions. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Deborah Kennedy. She is an Indiana author whose first novel, Tornado Weather, has been published to acclaim, was just published on Tuesday. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. What was the hardest thing about writing this book?
Oh, I think it was... I don't want to give anything away either.
Yeah.
But there was something that I had to do that I didn't enjoy with a character. But I guess actually one of the hardest parts, I'll just admit it, it's a craft thing. It's plot. I have difficulty with plot. A lot of the writers that I love to read don't necessarily... not a whole lot happens in their books. Catherine Mansfield is my favorite writer, gun to the head. And just very little happens in her stories on the surface. You know, there are no big moments, big reveals. And I love that. I love immersing myself in a slow, atmospheric book. But I needed to have things happen in my story, and to do it in a way that I hoped wasn't ham-fisted or too formulaic. And I think a lot of writers, plot is difficult. A lot of people make it look easy, but it's not. To have things happen in a believable and yet interesting way, and I still struggle with that all the time.
How did the structure come to you? Because there is a... it is a Weinsberg-like story where you see it unfold through a series of vignettes, multiple perspectives, you know, different people, even people, multiple first-person narrators at times. So, you know, there is kind of an intricate structure to it. How did that come to you and think, oh, gosh, I could make this all work?
I sort of saw it almost like you would... with an album, like a record. I wanted each chapter to build on the one previous to it, and I wanted them to talk to each other a little bit, to communicate with each other. So it's not necessarily chronological. It's more a build, and it sort of goes in waves, I think. And so I think of like a concept album to a certain extent, that, you know, certain songs next to each other then inform each other and kind of create a different sort of sonic experience. That doesn't probably make a whole lot of sense. But that was more how I did it. I didn't sit down and, you know, map it out or anything like that. I can't write that way. Mm. If I write that way, I won't finish it. I have to just kind of start and just go from there, and then kind of eventually maybe put some sort of structure on it. The chapters did get rearranged a few times because I wanted them to be, you know, speak more meaningfully to each other. So I think in the book there's a chapter called The Bombing about a young man serving in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And then there's another chapter about a bunch of ladies in a knitting circle. And that one, like the chronology there is a little wonky, but I wanted it to be that way because I thought it was more effective in what I was trying to get across with those characters. So I guess, yeah, I want the stories somehow to speak to each other, but it's not necessarily in any sort of like Freytag's pyramid or anything like that.
Well, what's interesting is that it's not the central mystery, the one that serves as the motif, is not the only mystery. You begin to see all sorts of other connections between the characters in the book, too. We're talking with Deborah Kennedy about her new book, Tornado Weather. If you want to join the conversation, you can find us on social media, or you can do what a listener named Bianca has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Bianca writes, "I love the title of the book. As a kid growing up in West Central Indiana, the title is so evocative of summers watching the darkening skies turn that sickly gray-green color, listening for the tornado sirens, and checking the sky from our porches." What made you choose that title? Do I sense some foreshadowing as well? Okay, well, yeah. I'll let you answer that one. And then she closes by saying, "Can't wait to read the book."
Oh, that's such a lovely question. Originally, the book was going to be titled Collarsville, based on a chapter about a young teenage girl who feels rather strangled by her surroundings. But then I thought about it, and I think the title came as a result of this idea about impending doom to a certain extent. The first chapter, where Ficus Ward is driving a school bus and he's noticing the ominous weather, and he thought he'd read something in his horoscope that suggested, you know, bad things were coming. And that thread runs throughout the book as well, that perhaps Collierville, because of its history of Indian slaughter, is doomed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And tornado weather, I think, so much more evocative. I think, like, as your reader said, or as your listener said, sorry, more evocative than a tornado warning, because it's like, okay, here's weather. It could happen, or maybe not. You know, it could all. I think in Indiana we have this phrase, "Oh, it's gonna blow over," right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of times it doesn't, especially if you're having a pool party. It doesn't blow over. It ruins your whole party. But so I thought the idea of tornado weather, the possibility of tragedy, that's really why I chose that title.
Was that part also of your, you know, I know we were talking before we went on the air about the fact that basically half of my family went to Hanover. I was the black sheep, went to Franklin College. But obviously tornado, the tornadoes that hit there and pretty much leveled the town were big. Was that part of the inspiration? Did that work in any way to help you shape because the tornado, I'm not going to give it away, but it does play a significant role.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, it did. Because there's a description in one of the chapters that I took directly from the Hanover tornado incident, because there, you know, it just leveled all these trees and made a trail at one point. And during one of the tours of Hanover that I took before I even went there, they pointed that out to us. And then they talked about how the whole campus came together to rebuild. And I thought that was really inspirational and pretty great. And I thought about that. And I think there was also an outbreak of tornadoes in Indiana in 1965, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. That was really devastating. So I just started reading about tornadoes. And it went from there.
We're talking with Hoosier author Deborah Kennedy about her debut novel, Tornado Weather, which has been published to acclaim. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with Hoosier author Deborah Kennedy, whose debut novel, Tornado Weather, just was published on Tuesday, already has won acclaim and widespread praise. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Lisa has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Lisa, you're on the air.
Deborah, I am very complimentary about the fact that you have done a book. You're a journalist. I'm a fellow classmate of John's, but not really. It's kind of like years have passed us. But nonetheless, I'm a journalist, and I have also worked in media. But I want to tell you that I applaud the fact that you have done a book based on all that you've just said in the last half hour. I've been listening avidly, and I have been so intrigued by how you have been so open about how you can do certain things and not do certain things. And I want to tell you, I look greatly to ordering your book and reading it.
Thank you.
My main question, well, it's really one personal, it's twofold. One, what newspaper did you work for in Northern Indiana? Because I worked for one in Northern Kentucky. But then the other one's professional. And it's to ask you, where did you get, and if you already talked about this, the gist of a bus stop kind of scenario. So you understand my twofold question?
I do, yeah.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Lisa.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So the newspaper that I worked at in Northern Kentucky, it was part of the community press newspapers and the community recorder newspapers, which are focused, given the title, on community. I worked for three different papers down there, the Boone County Recorder, the Community Recorder, and I think the Kenton County Reporter. We had lots of beats. We had to write 10 stories a week and take pictures. And but I guess actually my favorite was the Boone County, because that was more the rural area of Kentucky, and that's where I got to write about Rabbit Hash and the dog mayor. And I also wrote about a man who turned his truck into a replica of what Northern Kentucky. It was the Boone County Recorder. It was formative. It was a really wonderful job. As far as the bus stop abduction scenario, I had a friend who was working as a bus driver at the time that I was working on this book, actually, who was my partner at the time in Iowa City. And we talked a lot about his job, about the kids that he worked with every day. And I just thought that was probably a possible situation for Daisy. And also, I just like the idea of writing about Ficus and his relationship to the kids on the bus.
Which of the characters was the easiest for you to connect with? Because, as I say, you write with considerable empathy. And even though we haven't met before this, I can tell several of those characters are absolutely nothing like you.
No, that's true. And actually, the person that came the easiest is also nothing like me, Renee Seaver, in the Collarsville chapter. A lot of times when I sit down to write, the first voice that occurs to me is that of a sassy girl, teenage girl. And I think part of that is because, like I said before, I wasn't that kind of girl. I was basically timid, and I was not at all assertive or aggressive.
No, but having read the book, some of what you talked about, she does have that quality, though, of being an outsider looking in, too.
Yes.
Feeling displaced in school and, even in some ways disconnected from her family, which doesn't sound like was your case, but she has that outsider quality.
She does, and I think that that's probably the part of her that I related to. So every character in the book has some kernel of me in it, I think some little part of something, some thought I've had or experience I've had, and that is probably the part that I relate to the most in Renee, and also sort of her dreams of getting out a little bit. You know, she's an aspiring artist. And so that was something, too, about her that I could relate to. But it was her voice that came quite easily, because I think part of me voyeuristically wants to live in that person who can just say whatever she wants and not necessarily get away with it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that part, that kind of person is fun for me to inhabit.
Who was the hardest character to connect with, or?
I think there were two. Okay. Birdie Yoder and Shelley Pogue. Mm-hmm. These are two women that they're upset about the course that their town has taken after Hellman Yoder hires a number of undocumented workers. They kind of bristle at mm-hmm. the changes in their town. But at the same time, I feel like both women have very big hearts, particularly Shelley Pogue probably has a bigger heart than Birdie. Mm-hmm. But I find they're very different from who I am. At the same time, I do love them. I have known women like them. And so they were difficult to write, only in that I wanted to make sure that it came across that I love them as much as I did, and that I thought that I celebrate their humanity, even though, yeah, they're very different from me, and I wanted to give them each a little moment of grace, and I hope that I did that at the end of their chapters.
Well, and you said you started on this book in 2009, which by my math is 8 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's a long, long time to be working on. I'm assuming it went through multiple drafts.
Yes, multiple drafts.
How many?
Oh, goodness. I'd say probably four or five.
Okay. And by that, are we talking about just tweaks in chapters, or were there complete structural stuff?
These are large rewrites. Mm-hmm.
And did you do that before you found the publisher, or did you?
Probably two rewrites before I found, and then two or three after I found the publisher. Because that was something, too, that I learned with experience. I think when you're a young writer, you write something and you think, oh, that's brilliant. That needs to go in the New Yorker immediately. Mm-hmm. Why isn't the media beating down my door? And then, I don't know, I'm older now, and I realize that the heart of things is found in revision. You know, there's the cliche, all writing is rewriting, but it's true. And it's a tough lesson to learn, but it's important, because I feel like the story grew more true with each rewrite. And I'm grateful that I had the time and the readers helping me, you know, get it there.
What, you know, in terms of the revisions, when did you know it was done? Because there are writers, you know, who write and rewrite the famous story, obviously, supposedly about J.D. Salinger, is that he didn't stop writing after he stopped publishing, but he just kept revising and revising and revising and wouldn't let go of the story.
There comes a point, I think, to use an economic term, of diminishing returns, where you realize that you're working the juice out of it. You're taking something out of it that you know, could be there if you just left it alone. So I think there was a point when I was working a little too much on some of the believability mm-hmm. of the pieces that was stealing away some of the magic. It's like, okay, let's just leave this alone. Let's just call it good. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really instructive. For me to be like, okay, just learn when enough is enough, and not everything has to be absolutely completely believable. It should be accurate, but not necessarily realistic, or, you know, you don't need to get obsessed with mundane details about a character's age or something like that. That's rather workshoppy. That's something that people care about a lot in writers' workshops, but I think readers aren't as obsessed with that, those mm-hmm. kinds of details. So once I realized that it was sort of going in the wrong direction, that it was time to stop.
And when, at what process was that? What point was the the draft that we see now between the covers done?
Time frame?
You wanna,
Actually, it was a while ago. So the publication process has been rather lengthy also. Yeah. So I think this was finished about a year and a half ago.
Okay. Which leads me to my next question. Presumably, since this one has been done at some level for a year and a half, are you working on your next book now? What are you working on these days?
I just finished, finished in quotes, a book that's set in the near future in the Portland area after the big earthquake has struck. So
okay.
I don't know if out here you guys are as terrible. You're not. You have no reason to be as scared
Probably
of this.
Should emphasize, I know this because we've talked. You live in Portland, Oregon.
I do.
Outside of Portland, Oregon.
That's right. I do. And so I wrote a novel set in, like I said, the near future after the really big earthquake that everyone now is terrified of in the Pacific Northwest because it's inevitable. We don't know when it's going to strike, but it's going to strike and it's going to be devastating. So I wrote a novel set then dealing with the relationship of two sisters. One is at the coast when the earthquake happens. One is in the city of Portland. This is about an hour and a half drive distance, and they try to find each other after the earthquake. That's the gist of that novel. And I'm also working on another book set in Collierville, actually. I have sort of a prequel that's set specifically in Maple Leaf Mobile Home Park.
Okay.
And so I'm working on that as well, and also some suburb stories, some stories set in Windham on the River. I think I'm sort of obsessed with this town. I'm not done with it.
With Collierville?
Yes.
So we can expect you'll come back to it again. When do you think the Portland novel? When do you think that will be published?
Oh, I don't know. I just finished it, and frankly, I think it's a mess.
Okay.
I just had a baby 5 months ago, and so I was trying.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm very excited, and I'm exhausted. And I was finishing it during his, when he was a newborn. And so I know, again.
How did you do that?
I don't know.
There's no sleep. There's no sleep involved.
I have no idea. That's probably why it's a mess. So I think, again, this is probably going to be some revision and some rewriting.
How important, because obviously the writing you have done so far, they've been in places that you know and know well or have lived and inhabited and all of that. How important is place to your fiction?
Oh, it's incredibly important. In fact, I think place and character, that's why I probably admitted to having troubles with plot, because all of my stories start with place and then with character. There's a writer from Fort Wayne, I'm sure you know of him, Michael Martone.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And
Fort Wayne is seventh on Hitler's list.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he has a book called The Flatness and Other Landscapes.
Yeah.
And he writes just about how the atmosphere of Indiana, just how I think it's just so important to his work. And it is important to mine, too. There's something about this area that just gets in my bones and makes me want to write. And Portland as well now, now that I'm there, there's, unique aspects of that area that are getting into my writing. And I think that where we're from, a lot of people don't want to be labeled, I guess, by, where they're from or don't want to think of place as a key element. But for me, it is very big.
What elements of a place are important to you when you start to write? I mean, what aspects? You talked about the flatness of northern Indiana, and I think anyone who's driven through it knows what you're talking about, that literally most places you mow the lawn and you could play pool, basically. So, but what are the things that speak to you most powerfully about the specific places you've written about?
When I landed here in Indianapolis last night, I knew I was home. Indiana has a smell. I don't know how to describe it. And I miss it, actually, in Portland. I'm homesick for it. Tiger lilies and cornfields and strip malls, believe it or not. it's hard to explain exactly what strikes me and what is so important. But I know when I'm here, and even I was driving here today and I saw a hardware store that was a story. I know it's a story. I don't know why, but it will be someday. And so I don't think it's necessarily just the landscape, although the flatness does figure in. It's just everything that appeals to the senses. There's something visceral, I think, about your connection that you have with home. And I'm getting there with Oregon. I'm not quite there yet.
How long have you been in Oregon?
I've been in Oregon for four years. I moved there after I graduated from the workshop.
Okay. And probably should talk, because you're back here. While we would love to say you just came back here to do this show, in fact, you're here for a series of signings and readings. You talk a little bit about where you're going to be and where people can meet you if they want to get a copy of the book signed?
Absolutely. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble at River Crossing on River Crossing Parkway on Saturday the 15th at 1230, from 1230 to 3, I believe.
Yeah, for people in Indianapolis, that generally means Keystone at the Crossing.
Yes. Thank you for that translation. So I'll be there. I'll do a short reading, and then there'll be a Q&A and a signing. And then any Northerners or people who are going up north, I'll be in Fort Wayne at the Jefferson Point Barnes & Noble on Sunday the 16th at 2 p.m. doing the same thing.
What you say you're going to do a reading, that's often tough because it is, this is an intricate book. What are you going to, I don't want you to read it now, but what are you going to read from?
In Indianapolis, I'm going to read the chapter called Your Sister's Keeper, and it's about several ladies of a certain age who are in a Saturday morning knitter circle, and then sort of the tensions in their group that have been formed by a woman who has basically defected from the group. And she has, it was her grandson, Kenny, that was in the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read that, I guess, because I've been told by some friends that they feel like that's the most Indiana of all the chapters. I don't know why exactly, but so.
That's a tight competition, I guess I would say, because there's a lot of it that, for those of us who know Indiana well, the book resonates with that. What's your relationship with the book now? I mean, I remember talking late Hoosier author Kurt Vonnegut about his books, and he would say, you know, by the time you're through all the revisions, I'm so sick of it, I don't ever want to see it again.
Right.
What's yours now?
I think there is always a certain amount of that, and especially since I've been writing it for so long. And I started it when I was basically a different person 8 years ago. And so there's a certain amount of, oh, cringing, did I really write that? But I think that that's almost every writer looks back on their early writing and gets uncomfortable. But at the same time, I love it. It's my baby. It's my first one. So I'm still excited about it.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us, Deborah Kennedy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I really did enjoy and admire your book. Also like to thank our listeners for sharing some great questions and comments, as usual. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.